This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you were standing on what is now Tryon Street 234 years ago this Friday, you might have wanted to get out of the way, or at least duck for cover, because you would have found yourself in the middle of the Battle of Charlotte. To most of the rest of the nation, this battle might be an unknown part of the American Revolution. In point of fact, it was a significant battle in some ways, and one we'll learn more about later in the program. First, something else that is just slightly younger, only 223 years old, the Old Farmer's Almanac. That's how long it's been around, and even in today's digital world, it continues to attract readers to its homespun wisdom, recipes, witticisms, farming insights, and, of course, predictions on the weather. In the last 200 years, there have only been 13 editors. The 13th is also the publication's first female editor, and the history-making Janice Stillman, who started that job in 2000, joins us now. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. This publication that you edit started in 1792, and it's called the Old Farmer's Almanac. But there's another publication simply called the Farmer's Almanac, masquerading around. Aside from being the real McCoy, what's the difference between yours and theirs?
Boy, well, the difference may be night and day to true readers of the Old Farmer's Almanac and those others. But, you know, it's really appropriate to explain that farmers' almanacs as a genre are as old as dirt. From what I understand, they date back from the early ancient Egyptians and indeed were carved on sticks back then. But folks who grow their food and keep animals needed to know what to do, how to do it well, when to do various stages from sowing to harvesting to fertilizing to, you know, feeding and slaughtering. So farmers' almanacs as a genre have always been around. And the fellow pictured, one of the fellows pictured on the cover of ours, Robert B. Thomas, the one on the right. The other is Benjamin Franklin. They were not contemporaries. Franklin, of course, is the father of almanacs and the founder of Poor Richard's Almanac. But Robert B. Thomas grew up in the mid-1700s and in Massachusetts, and he read a number of the farmers' almanacs that were available then. And, of course, they were pamphlets by today's measure. And he realized, as he grew up using them, he grew up on a farm, everybody did back then, he just thought, these are kind of plain, they're kind of, you know, maybe helpful, but maybe not really the best it could be. So being fascinated with astronomy and recognizing that an almanac by definition is a calendar of the heavens, he set about learning about astronomy. He worked with an almanac maker, as they were called, in Boston. In the year 1792, prepping all the astronomical data for 1793. And then he added editorial content. And in this earliest one, about 40 pages, he determined to make it useful, but with a pleasant degree of humor. And that really, for all time now, 223 years, seems to be the distinguishing factor between the Old Farmer's Almanac and just about every other one out there. So farmers' almanacs have always been out there, like news magazines, fashion magazines, sports magazines. But the Old Farmer's Almanac is the one that seems to make people smile, that certainly is the best-selling across the U.S. and Canada. We print 3.1 million copies a year. I can't speak for the others, of course, but you'll always recognize the yellow cover. It hasn't changed since really from the first. You know, it's the one that most people think of when they think of Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah, it's the yellow cover with the two portraits of Benjamin Franklin on the left, your founder on the right, and then to the left and right of the big date in the center.
Exactly.
The year. It took 208 years for the Old Farmer's Almanac to get its first female editor. I know that the almanac, for all those years, must have had tons of female readers. What took so long to get a female editor?
Boy, I don't know. Certainly Robert B. Thomas was the editor from the first edition until he was 80 years old.
Till 1950, and, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, somebody commented to me once, since the Old Farmer's Almanac was founded when George Washington was president, they said, look at how many presidents we've had in the same time, but only 13 editors of the Old Farmer's Almanac. So, you know, it was just lucky, and I feel tremendously honored to be the editor of this American icon, and more importantly, to be able to continue to satisfy folks and provide them what they expect in the publication.
So when you came in as editor, and I know you're talking about trying to maintain tradition and provide people what they've come to expect, did you make any changes because you're bringing a new perspective that had never been there before?
You know, it's very subtle. One of the things that we did in one of the first issues, I've been here since 2000, by the way, was to add the little black tab, so to speak, on the edges of the page to better find the calendar pages and the weather section. But, you know, folks don't want to see the Old Farmer's Almanac change. We have done surveys every other year, well, for decades, and invariably folks say, you know, when we ask, what would you like to see differently? We may propose several ideas, and they say, don't change a thing. Because, to be honest with you, I think they, maybe even sometimes better than we, understand that the almanac, by definition, is a calendar of the heavens. And thus, you've got the calendar pages with the columns of numbers, which actually define the year, the day. They measure out the length of day with the rising and setting of the sun.
Who figures all that out? Do you have to figure that out every year, or has it now become so rote that you can, and it does duplicate, I would think, from maybe every 10 years, there may be an interval where the charts are exactly the same. Do you have to figure it out, or...
We actually, that's an excellent question, yes. We, broadly speaking, we have two astronomers who provide the astronomical data in the same way that we have a meteorologist who provides the weather. So we go to the experts. And you're right, there may be, it's never really come up, and we wouldn't deign to just assume that the timings of such events would be so exacting that we could simply copy a year. We provide new information. In fact, the entire book is fresh. It's a blank page when we start, you know, from one year to the next. So every piece of information is reviewed and updated as necessary, and certainly, yes, the calendar pages.
When do you start working? The 2015 is out, so the 2016, have you begun?
Well, much of the content, not all of it, because we're, you know, it's really an open window until, by say, February or March, you know, that most of the editorial is in. Then the weather forecasts start to come in, and we push those, you know, as far as we can allow the meteorologist time, you know, it's February and March, and then we have to go into layout and proofing and like that, because the almanac being, again, in 3.1 million copies needing to be printed, folks sometimes maybe forget how much time printed and bound, and then the whole punched in 2.5 million of them, and, you know, various things getting them into the, loaded properly into the displays, and then into the trucks, and then distributed. It's printed typically in July or the 4th of July weekend, and moves into stores within 5 to 8 weeks. And, you know, so now, as I said, we've got most of the content, but we're also producing the Old Farmer's Almanac All Seasons Garden Guide for release in February. We're producing 7 or 8 calendars of varying themes, from weather to country to recipes to engagement and everyday. We produce an Old Farmer's Almanac for Kids edition every 2 years, and we're right now working on this Volume 6, which will be available next fall with the 2016 Old Farmer's Almanac. So, as some people have said to me, you have the easiest job in the world. You produce one magazine a year. And I said, oh, you don't even know. And then there's the cookbooks, indeed. We've got the Old Farmer's Almanac Comfort Cookbook this year, in addition to Cooking Fresh, the Bookazine magazine, which is available in a lot of supermarkets, when, grocery stores, and like that.
When Robert Thompson, or Thomas rather, published the very first edition in 1792, the United States, what little there was of it, was an agrarian culture. There were no grocery stores. Everybody grew their own food. There was no TV weather. So much of the information that you supplied was only available through an almanac, and that includes the growing tips, and it was vital information to the people.
You're absolutely right.
Are people using this almanac differently today?
I don't know about differently, because it goes back to the idea that, you know, it really has a core message and core ingredients, you know, whether it's the planting by the moon dates. A lot of folks do, it's the tradition, like you mentioned, and when I think of the planting by the moon, a lot of folks subscribe to that theory that planting by the moon, in the same way that the moon has an influence on tides, it, in a very, very small, much smaller, even minute way, has an influence on moisture in the soil. And so planting above ground or below ground can affect the success, the germination, and therefore the ultimate success of the plant. So certainly best fishing days, you know, quitting smoking, different things like that in the best days. Certainly, yes, people use it in much of the same way, but we also have the website, almanac.com, which gives them an immediate 24/7 opportunity to get information and ask questions. We have hundreds of questions a week from folks around the country, especially during growing and harvesting season, mostly about vegetables. I mean, we all know that more and more people are growing something these days. Tomatoes has been the number one vegetable, well, fruit, I guess, specifically for folks to grow now for years. But they're also getting into the herbs and, you know, other specific favorites from one place to the next. So I think that that's really part of what the Old Farmer's Almanac is enjoying now, just a resurgence of interest in traditions, whether it's home remedies or, you know, just recipes or just the quirky, anything that takes you away from the news sometimes,
yeah,
too, you know, but brings you back to the natural rhythm and glory of nature.
Well, speaking of the news, your claim to fame, the Almanac's claim to fame, or at least one of the big claims to fame, is the weather. And, of course, weather is available now, has been available for years on television every day. It's available on our smartphones in an instant. But you're making weather forecasts that are, if I listen to your earlier comment, a year and a half out in some cases.
Right.
Because if the meteorologists start filtering in information to you in February, you go to press in July, and it's for the following year. You're almost 2 years out on some of these. Can you
about 18 months?
Can you?
Yeah.
I mean, there are meteorologists who have told me we can't even predict what's going to happen on Saturday with any certainty. Going long range forecasts are just like throwing a dart at a dartboard that's maybe 6 miles away. How accurate have you been over the years with these long range forecasts?
Traditionally, we're 80% accurate, and you have to remember that we're not going to predict exactly what the temperature will be or the amount of precipitation or snowfall, but we're going to tell you the deviation from the normal.
How does that 80% accuracy compare with the National Weather Service?
Well, you know, given that we're playing two different games here, so to speak, which is to say long range and short range, I don't think, you know, we're comparing apples and oranges as opposed to apples and apples, so we don't really track the National Weather Service, but I will tell you this, is that our meteorologist indicated and predicted in his general weather forecast, it's on the black and white page immediately following the color section in every edition, that we would have a weak to neutral El Nino way back, like I said, in February. And there were numerous relatively short-range meteorologists who thought that the El Nino would indeed grow warmer and that would lead to rainfall in California, which we would all love to see. But then they pulled back only a couple of weeks ago, and they said, you know what, it's really not going to go that way. But we had anticipated that early on. So, yes, it's a lucky call. Yes, you might say it's a 50-50. But nonetheless, we got it right. And indeed, we got last winter 80.6% accurate. And what is, I have to admit, even more remarkable to me is that our prediction for the temperatures differed from actual conditions by only 1.78 degrees Fahrenheit. That's less than 2 degrees difference between what we said across much of the country on average than what actually occurred.
And so, last winter was an unusual winter, so it wasn't like you were pulling a boilerplate forecast out of your files. It was actually...
Oh, heavens, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, it's never boilerplate. No, again, everything is done from the start.
Let me stop you, Janice, because we have to take a break. Janice Stillman is the editor of the Old Farmer's Market, Old Farmer's Almanac. We're coming back to talk more about that publication and maybe get a little weather prognostication for our area for the fall and winter. Stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's Uncorked, an afternoon of wine sampling on Saturday, featuring wines from 15 different vineyards and live music from Alejandro Escovedo. That's usnwc.org. And South State Bank, a community bank with strong southern roots in operation since 1934. Information online at southstatebank.com. Tomorrow at 9 on this program, we talk to the ambassador of Belgium to the United States. And then, well, tomorrow afternoon, we record a show that will air on Friday, a special show about the history and growth of Charlotte's beer scene. We'll be recording this at the Old Mecklenburg Brewery. We start at 6:30 tomorrow night. We'll be there beginning at 5, and you can attend the broadcast. Details at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the NFL is considered a nonprofit and pays no federal income taxes. But recent controversies are prompting new questions about that exemption. Debate over the NFL's tax benefits.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment or two, we'll talk about the anniversary, the 234th anniversary of the Battle of Charlotte, which celebrates that anniversary on Friday of this week. But right now, we're talking with Janice Stillman, who is the editor at the Old Farmer's Almanac, which is but 223 years old, a mere infant in comparison to the Battle of Charlotte. And we were talking before the break about weather, and the almanac's remarkable, really it is, it's remarkable accuracy with regard to weather predictions that are made way, way, way in advance in terms of the scale of things, I suppose. You also offer readers ways to discover surefire methods, you say, for predicting the weather themselves based on animal signals, cloud types, and even pig spleens. Really?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Well, there are some traditions. You know, the animal signals really are the proverbs that, you know, folks have, they used before they had all the technology and, you know, scientific data that we have today. And, you know, there when various ones lie down or even things like when leaves turn over and rain comes, and what everybody loves, I think, is that pink sky in morning, sailors take warning, pink mm-hmm. sky at night, sailors delight. You know, so the proverbs, the weather proverbs are great fun, and we try to include a few in the book, but they are not what we use to make our weather
okay.
forecast.
All right. Just checking. Now, in Charlotte, we had what many of us considered to be a cool, wet summer, but yesterday I read in the paper that aside from having no 100-degree days this summer, our weather was average in terms of rainfall and temperature. Did you predict that? I don't know if you know the answer to this question. Did you predict that for Charlotte in the 2014 almanac?
I would have to look that up,
okay,
but I'm looking, for example, that, you know, down in your area, we're pretty close to having a normal season. I mean, each season every month is different and predicted differently, but I would... You can check it.
Okay. Well, what do you see ahead for the fall of this year and the beginnings, the winter of 2015 for this area?
Well, we're calling it refrigeration for the east and two-thirds of the country. And you folks are really kind of on a piece of land that is kind of between cold and very snowy and cold and very wet. So depending on which way the wind blows, you could get rain and you could get snow. It really depends on what you like. If you look at the color weather map that folks might pick up the almanac, it's on page 96, and you can see that, you know, it's not a hard and fast line between cold and snowy and cold and wet, and that's why I say it could blow either way. But certainly much colder than normal, much colder even than last winter, the meteorologist has told me. So we're looking at conceivably a snowstorm right before Christmas. Very cold weather and snow just about any time in January. And then a snowstorm in early February, and if that's not enough, and I'm sure a lot of people will think it is, late March you could also see another snowstorm, and that's at least to be a nuisance.
I guess I looked at the map, and the line that you're talking about goes just to the west of the Charlotte area. By the way, I have a complaint.
Uh-oh.
We're in Zone 4 on your weather map. You on that weather map in Zone 4, you mark Raleigh, Columbia, Atlanta, and Savannah. I think it's time for you to put the 16th largest city in the country on that weather map.
Oh, my. All right. Well, congratulations on that one. I will talk to our meteorologist. Yes. Again, because you kind of straddle the area, you know, we'll see.
We are the area. We are the capital. We are the capital of the Carolinas. Don't let anybody tell you anything other than that. We're the capital right here. Let's see here. Let's talk about some of the other things, because you talk about other things other than weather. And one of the things, I didn't know you did this until I read this yesterday, you look at trends for the year ahead. What will be happening next year, trend-wise?
That's an excellent question. That's part of the almanac as a time capsule of the year. It's our predictions for what folks can expect.
Are you as accurate with these predictions as you are with the weather?
You know, I think it's even more so.
Oh, my gosh.
the woman who puts this together constantly amazes me with, because then I'll see in the through the headlines in other news media throughout the course of the year, the things that she gathered up last summer. So things like hamburgers made from laboratory-grown meat.
That's going to be a thing next year?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It may not be your preference.
I know McDonald's is struggling, but please don't go there.
There you go. Capsules in your body that take and transmit pictures to doctors.
That's a real selfie, isn't it? That's a real selfie.
Speaking of which, yes, that's an interior selfie, but selfies are actually going to become passé, and the thing is going to be shelfies.
What?
Pictures of the books on your shelf. Remember books?
Yeah. You're saying that people are going to start taking pictures of books?
And
putting them on social media?
That's what we found out, yes. Just be ready. Be ready.
Right.
Corduroy upholstery.
Okay.
Macrame is back.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Speaking of bookcases, baby changing tables have become bookcases. Now, that's a little bit, I hope they put a doily or something on that, but that's just my opinion.
Well, speaking of baby changing, one of the other ones that caught my eye was diapered pet chickens.
And shouldn't they all be, really? That's so that you can keep them in the house. I mean, the home, not just the chicken coop. Folks will be doing that. You know, years ago, and this is one of the things that I love. I learned this years ago in the old Farmer's Almanac. But farmers used to put little leather shoes on turkeys to walk them to market. And indeed, taking your chicken out for a walk, we had a story in that. People collect their almanac editions. But if you go back a few years, we had a story on taking your chickens for a walk, and folks did it for centuries, hundreds of years ago.
You know, I just want to plant this seed in your mind that perhaps the lady that does this, these trend predictions for you, check to see if she's been dipping into the cider, okay? Just check on that if you would. You mentioned thealmanac.com, which is your website, and I know that the website gives you limited access to the publication, but you can actually buy a digital subscription now or a digital copy and get full access. How many people choose to read it online versus buy the print version of the Almanac now?
We sell thousands now. The digital edition, and indeed a PDF edition that you can read on your computer screen, has been available now for a few years, and each year the number keeps growing. You know, we are the old Farmer's Almanac, but we're not old-fashioned, and so we have been in step with multiple channel media and, you know, various other aspects of information provision. Really from the start. We've had a website since 1995, which seems ancient, but hundreds of pages, great opportunities to communicate with us. We have a feedback page and lots of pages, especially the gardening pages, provide an opportunity to ask, and they do, specific questions about planting season, harvesting, pests. And we, each of the editors here, every day answers several questions. So it's a very active website. We had 10 million visits last month alone.
Who are your readers? Young, old, black, white, city, country? Who are they? Male,
you know,
female?
In this day and age, it's about 50-50 male and female, but, you know, the answer to the rest of it is really everybody, because, again, with the 3 million circulation in the time when print seems to be, and God bless us all, but seems to be fading in some circles, you know, we have everybody's gardening, everybody's growing something. Folks are tuning in for the fishing days or you know, there's so many things. The weather, certainly, especially when storms come around. We had thousands of visitors when on the first day of fall. When does the fall actually start? And for every holiday, we get those kinds of questions. You know, so it's really everybody's using it for a variety of reasons, and that's why the Old Farmer's Almanac is such a mix of information that it does fulfill its mission as a calendar of the heavens. But it's you know, it's just, it's the most reliable resource. There was a film with Hepburn and Tracy. You remember them?
Yes, I do, actually.
Several years ago. I know a few people of a certain age might remember this. I forget the name of the movie, but she was she was in charge of a local newspaper, and she and an assistant are going through the mail, and it's like, oh, send it to accounting, send it to, you know, the news desk. Oh, this one, send it to the Old Farmer's Almanac. They'll surely have an answer. And, you know, it was just delightful. This was, what, in the 1940s, I think, right, to see that everybody, even then in Hollywood, recognized that the Old Farmer's Almanac was indeed a reference book. People expect us to have the answer, and darn it, we do try, and I think we get most of it.
You mentioned something called best days. You mentioned the best days to fish, and I could see where that could be predicted somewhat by weather prognostication and the position of the moon and things like that. But part of the best days feature is different from that. For instance, on Monday of this week, it was a best day to quit smoking. Yesterday, it was a best day to get dental care and to end projects. Why?
That you're referring to, and you're looking, of course, in the 2014, I presume, because this is, you know, the 20. So they just are the most propitious days based on astrological readings. And they said the astrology, and I sometimes trip over this, the astrology pages versus the astronomy pages. And indeed, some say that the earliest almanacs were entirely based on astrology. Needless to say, we are not now. But we do include these pages. Folks have told us over the years that indeed the best days to quit smoking are those identified here. People have the best success. Mm-hmm. For castrating animals. Farmers, I've been on radio shows like this, in particular in Central Florida, and three gentlemen called in, three farmers, and they said, we use the best days because there is less bleeding. I've read about this in making sausage as well. But
you know, castration and sausages are two topics that I do not want to hear in the same paragraph. I just don't want to hear that.
That's why the Old Farmer's Almanac makes you smile.
Yes, indeed. Before we go, you also have a puzzle of the day, a question of the day, advice of the day, word of the day. Is that
on the website? Yes.
Is that a department? Does somebody come up? How do you come up with these? Is somebody assigned this? How do you choose the word of the day?
Well, we do have a very dedicated, God bless her, she is tremendously dedicated web editor, and she keeps that all up to date and keeps it fresh and different for folks all year long. So we don't at this point have to go in every single day. We can automate a certain amount of this, but we do certainly try to keep it fresh and new for folks.
Janice,
and you can actually get those as an app, too, so that's something to think about.
Wow, okay. Everybody has an app these days.
There's an app for that.
That's right. Janice Stillman is the editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. The 2015 edition is ready to go. It's on the stands. It's going to be a wet, cold winter.
But you know what? You can take comfort with those comfort food recipes in the Old Farmer's Almanac. Cook it up and just absolutely relax.
Janice, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been terrific.
You're welcome. Well, it's true that Charlotte looks sparkly and new, but it has a long history, and part of that history occurred this week, 234 years ago, the Battle of Charlotte. Now, we love to debate Charlotte and Mecklenburg's contribution to American independence through the fuzzy provenance of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. But the Battle of Charlotte requires no debate. It happened right there on Tryon Street and points north. And despite the fact that the rest of the country may not know much about it, it turned out to be a significant altercation in the course of our struggle to break away from England. We find out more from one of the people who knows this history best. Scott Seifert is co-founder of the May 20th Society. That's the organization that promotes the so-called MECDEC. He's also the author of the First American Declaration of Independence, the disputed history of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775. Welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Good to see you. Also with us is a man doing his part to commemorate history and add a little historic flavor to our otherwise almost brand new looking town. Chas Fagan is a sculptor and artist who did the James Jack statue. No, it's not Paul Revere. I thought it was Paul Revere, but no, it's not. James Jack statue along the Little Sugar Creek Greenway near CPCC. It was about to add to our collection of public revolutionary art, and we'll find out how in a moment. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
This is how long we go back. The last time Chaz was on this program, he was talking about presidential portraiture.
Yes.
Which is one of the things that you do. People may not know that you are literally world famous at doing this. And you were doing the show with us at Caribou Coffee.
Yes.
That was about 233 years ago, I think. we can thank this battle, the Battle of Charlotte, for the name of our basketball team.
That's right. That's right.
Because isn't this why Lord Cornwallis called us a hornet's nest of rebellion?
Well, that's exactly right. So the British moved into town 234 years ago and occupied the area for 2 weeks. But first, as they rolled into town up South Tryon, they were confronted with 150 militia officers and men who fired at them from behind trees, behind the courthouse in the middle of Trade and Tryon Street. And the British cavalry charged them three times, and three times were repulsed. They suffered 12 killed and 40 wounded until finally Cornwallis himself was angry enough to say, essentially, this is ridiculous. You need to move forward. I think his words were, you have nothing to gain and everything to lose. Sure. So they moved in and they took the city. But yes, in occupying the city, they were ambushed various places, and Cornwallis famously calls it a damned hornet's nest of rebellion.
Yes, I think they were surprised by the resistance that they met, and I believe the exact quote Lord Cornwallis said to the patriots gathered there, it's not cricket, you're not playing the game, because they didn't roll over.
I hadn't heard that one.
Stan Freberg presents the United States of America. That's where that came from. If this battle is so significant, and it turns out to be somewhat significant because it was kind of a tide-turning moment in the American Revolution,
right.
Why does nobody know about it? Why, you know, we hear about Bunker Hill, and we hear about Lexington and Concord, and we hear about Yorktown, and we hear about Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox down in South Carolina.
Right.
Why didn't we learn this in American history? Why hasn't Disney done a movie about this?
Well, it's a great question.
Upcoming.
It's coming up. No, but that statement goes for everything about Charlotte history in this period, doesn't it, really? I mean, we've forgotten largely about the Mecklenburg Declaration or even the controversy. We forgot about the Mecklenburg Resolves. The Battle of Charlotte is something that really I didn't know about until 10 years ago. I mean, this is classic Charlotte in that there was a hardcore kernel of people who kept it alive. But, you know, we were a forward-looking city. We were big business and big buildings, and we didn't care about this stuff.
Oh, yeah, now.
Now, I'm sorry. Yeah. You're asking why don't anybody know about this? And I think we've just kind of forgotten a lot of this.
But, I mean, I know there wasn't a significant battle in terms of casualties,
right.
Although there were numbers of casualties here. But it did involve Tarleton, General Tarleton.
That's right, Bannister Tarleton.
It did involve Lord Cornwallis, who was also a famous British general. It involved some people who are famous in this area because of their last names, which we'll talk about.
Right.
But it's not in the history books, not that I know of.
Well, and that's not exactly true. And if, in fact, Tarleton in his memoirs describes it as the skirmish of an enemy Charlotte. He describes the area, the people living here, as more hostile to England than any other in America. So, but it wasn't a major engagement. I mean, it was a minor skirmish for that reason. But it was certainly something that we celebrated until very recently.
Scott Seifert is the author of the first American Declaration of Independence. Chaz Fagan, who has yet to speak, but we'll get to him right after the break, is a sculptor and artist, and he did the Captain Jack statue down there by CPCC on the Sugar Creek Greenway, and has more planned. We'll come back and talk about that as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court with regulators and at the deal table with offices in Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. And Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia. September delivers the new Subaru 2015 Outback. All-wheel drive, all-terrain, and fuel-efficient. 3 additional cubic feet interior and next-generation eyesight. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. The NFL is considered a nonprofit organization, and as a result, they pay no federal income taxes. But recent controversies are prompting new questions about that exception. And Diane Rehm and her guests review the debate over the NFL's tax benefits coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking about the Battle of Charlotte, which took place this week. I think Friday is the date. In 1780, if you're standing on Tryon Street, duck. We're coming right back.
In the last several years, there's been an explosion of interest in craft beer and microbreweries in the Queen City and around the country. Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins will record a special show about the history and growth of Charlotte's beer scene at Old Mecklenburg Brewery this Thursday night. The recording is at 6:30, but Mike and the WFAE staff will be there from 5 to 8. So stop by and join us. Details at WFAE.org and click on events.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Battle of Charlotte, which occurred 234 years ago this Friday on Tryon Street, right in the middle of town. Right in the middle of town, on the square. Scott Seifert's with us. He knows all about this. Chaz Fagan is a sculptor and artist, a presidential portrait artist, and also a man who is very accomplished with lots of statuary gathered around the country. One of the statues is of Captain Jack, which is down there on the Greenway, which just appeared a couple of years ago, and he's on a horse galloping through the fountain. I thought it was Paul Revere because he's got a tri-cornered hat on, and that's who I associate with somebody, a patriot with urgency, going to tell the people, one if by land, two if by sea, the British are coming, the British are coming. It's Captain Jack. Who is Captain Jack?
A quick answer, he was just the tavern owner on Train Street.
And why is he riding so quickly? Is he out of grog?
Well, he was selected as the guy to carry the document with all everyone's names on it.
That would be the Declaration, the Mecklenburg Declaration.
Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, and basically, you know, a warrant for anyone's arrest or death if it was found. Mm-hmm. And he was the one they trusted to take it up there surreptitiously.
Who commissioned the statue?
The May 20th Society.
The May 20th Society. You must be rolling in it. This man is world known. How could they afford you?
Oh, I got hooked early. So I think it was very soon after moving to Charlotte, I opened the paper and there's a story about Captain Jack.
He's drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I'm in.
because Chaz Fagan, your work includes several statues that you did for the National Cathedral in Washington, a bas-relief bust of President Reagan mounted on a piece of the Berlin Wall for the USS Reagan, the statue of President Reagan that stands in the Capitol building in Washington, and you designed and created the Bush Monument for the city of Houston, including an 8-foot statue of George Herbert Walker Bush. And each assignment, I would guess, brings different – and you have all these presidential portraits that you've done as well. Each assignment brings, I would guess, different challenges. But at least in the case of these presidents, and Presidents Reagan and Bush, you knew precisely what they looked like. And I'm sure that they were told – you were told what kind of a feeling that they wanted to get out of the statue or out of the portrait. We don't know what Captain Jack looks like, do we?
No.
But, so how do you approach something like that?
Well, my method is you try to find as much as you can. And we have lots of descendants. And when this project started, I didn't know how famous this guy was, actually. He became famous because of his name was associated with this document and the courage of going north. But when the project started, we gathered as many photographs of descendants as we possibly could. I pinned them all up together. A huge wall. Wow. And looked to try to see if there are any similarities whatsoever.
And were there?
You know, it was really hard.
it's been a long time. Yeah. There's been a lot of evolution in the DNA.
You go from smiling family photographs to somber, you know, portraits. But the result was yes. I mean, I thought I had something in my head, and I just went with it. And then the irony is that on the day of the unveiling, there was a family member or descendant from California, I believe he was. And the resemblance was incredible.
Really?
So at least on one, I maybe have hit, yeah. I had one out of 1,000 there.
His full name was James Jack. Was he a part of the Battle of Charlotte?
It's not clear. You know, what's interesting about Captain Jack, he's become so famous now in Charlotte, much more than he ever was, frankly, even during his lifetime. And you've got the statue and the emblem and the Liberty Walk and things like that. But we don't know that much about him. There are some rumors that he was fighting with the militia. He was a militia officer in this area.
Because the British burned his house down after the battle.
That's correct. They burned his house down. They took his aged and ill father, who could not get off his bed, and they carried him on his bed and dumped him in the street. According to one story, according to another story, they threw him out the window and killed him. But in either event, they then burned the house down. So we don't know exactly what Jack was doing. It would be logical if he was fighting, you know, in his hometown as a militia officer.
He was down by CPCC riding through the fountain.
That's he might have been doing that. He was walking his chicken that day.
let's talk about Charlotte at the time of this, because this was around the time that General Washington referred to us as a trifling place and Lord Cornwallis as a hornet's nest of rebellion. What were we like? The British had already gone through Georgia and South Carolina and done terrible things, and here they come marching up Tryon Street. What would they have seen as they marched through Tryon had the rebels been quieter?
They would have, and here's what we know what they saw, because Tarleton, for example, writes in his memoirs after the war, he said, and this sounds very much like Charlotte, the roads were narrow and crossed in every direction. there was thick woods. There was only maybe 10 log cabins scattered around a muddy town common where the courthouse was located.
And the courthouse was on the corner of Trade and Tryon.
It was right in the middle of the street.
In the middle of the
street. In the middle of the street. That's exactly right. As was common in European English villages.
Was it a traffic circle or something? Or it was a square.
It was a square.
Okay.
With the building in the middle. And actually to visualize you can imagine the people coming up from the south, so you have the British coming up. Mm-hmm. And what they see is a log house that's on these pillars. Mm-hmm. And below was used as a marketplace. So between the pillars were like counter height walls of stone where they could, you know, trade your goods. Now it's from behind those that there were some key, you know, snipers.
And this is why I say it's not cricket, you're not playing the game, because the British come in, the redcoat regulars come in a military style that has been the style for much of European history. And here we are crouching behind walls and trees and buildings and not presenting ourselves, just firing away.
And firing away, yeah, somewhat against the rules of civilized warfare. Yeah. Of course, the rules of civilized warfare, in quotes, were the British would occupy an area, then they would steal everyone's chicken, pigs, hogs, and burn down the houses they didn't like. So
if it weren't raining right now and people mm-hmm. were listening and they wanted to retrace this battle, where would you start? Where did the British come from?
You would want to start at South Tryon in front of the Gantt Center, where there is a large stone that describes the war in the South during this period. And it actually has a bronze relief of the Battle of Charlotte. Then if you continue up South Tryon along the Charlotte Liberty Walk, there are various stops that take you all the way to the square where the Battle of Charlotte marker is.
Okay. And where did the actual gunfire begin?
It would have started as when the horses were coming up South Tryon, the cavalry would have attacked the courthouse. So 50 to 75
they
yards
weren't planning
from
to
the
attack.
Courthouse.
They weren't planning to attack the courthouse. They attacked because they were being fired upon, surprisingly fired upon.
They suspected that when you entered a town of any size, and this was not a very small town, it was a very small town, that there would be insurgents or a problem. That's why the cavalry went first. So they roll into town and they get fired off, and they assume that there'd be only a handful of people, not 150 militia.
Now, this group of British soldiers, as I understand it, was being led by British Major George Hanger, who
That's
charged
right.
into town despite Tarleton, whose first name is escaping
me.
Bannister Tarleton, right.
Bannister Tarleton's admonition to be cautious, and
right.
he was met with a hail of gunfire. He should have listened to Tarleton, because why did Tarleton think he needed to be cautious?
Because they know that
he'd been around the countryside, right, and seeing how people were not necessarily welcoming here.
I see.
They were expecting a welcoming committee with favorable royalists.
And then there's, I can't think of his first name either for some reason, Davy, on our side.
William R. Davy.
Say it again?
William R. Davy.
William R. Davy, whose name is on a street and a county. Mm-hmm. his strategy for the Americans was pretty tricky. It involved troops in three different locations, which led to great confusion among the British. It's a pretty tricky strategy here. What did he do?
Mm-hmm. Well, so the Battle of Charlotte is a bit of a misnomer because it's really a delaying action. So they harass the British as they come into town just so they know that they're here in hostile territory. Then they retreat along North Tryon for 7 miles, and they will stop at creeks or small roads and fight the British as they pursue them.
I see. So what time of day did this take place?
I believe it was sort of mid-morning.
So if you wanted to do this on Friday when it's not going to be raining, you could be there at the same time 234 years
could.
Later.
You
how
could
long,
bring bagpipes. You could do the whole thing.
Bring your own cannon, please. How long did the skirmish last at the square?
Probably not more than 20 or 30 minutes. But then the fighting continues all the way up to what's now Sugar Creek, was then Sugar Creek Presbyterian Church, mm-hmm. where there's a hand-to-hand combat with Joseph Graham, who's almost killed and almost left for dead, and his men fighting the British on horseback, which actually becomes the scene in The Patriot where they're doing similar fighting. But
another street, Graham Street.
That's right. That's right.
In those initial attacks downtown, the British suffered what are described as major casualties. So as a result of that, General Cornwallis sent in the light infantry, which caused the Patriots to retreat to the north. Mm-hmm. And they stood their ground first at what is now Brookshire Freeway.
Right.
Along a muddy creek there.
That's right. That's right.
And then later retreated to where the historic Rosedale Plantation stands today, and then continued to go further north. And one of the tricky aspects about the strategy at the square, I think, was after the initial volley, the Patriots looked like they were retreating, when in fact they were drawing them into other gunfire.
That's correct? Right.
The next line.
Pretty tricky stuff.
Next line, that's right.
When the British got as far north as Mallard Creek, they found the main American army under the direction of another street, William Lee Davidson.
Right.
But instead of fighting the Americans, the British turned around and went back to Charlotte. So if they were able to come back to this hornet's nest, did we win or did we lose?
Well, yeah.
Well, they occupied at the time. They figured they had it. They moved on and they had the land. So
the rule is if you keep the ground,
sat.
You win the battle. Yep. So they kept the ground. Right?
So, but it was okay. So we kind of lost. But would this have been different had Tarleton led the charge instead of Hager or whatever? His
right. That's important. So Tarleton is sick, so he's physically unable to go in, and therefore it might have been the same outcome. But you got to bear in mind the British army is 2,000 to 3,000. Soldiers and the militia on our side repelling the British are 150. So this is never intended as a full scale battle like the size of Camden or Cowpens. This is merely a delaying action.
It's a continuation of stuff that had happened or worked, because just a few days before there was the Wahab plantation event where Davy, using the I think with the help of the guy who actually used to own the plantation before it was taken over by Cornwallis, ambushed them, and it was incredible. They ambushed them out of the cornfields and were totally surprised. They stole the 96 horses, and so all that happened just days before.
Was any of this coordinated with the so-called Continental Army, which was the army of the Americans? Was it coordinated, or was this simply people saying, here they come, let's pick up our guns and do our thing?
Loosely coordinated. Right. There was communication, but the fighting in the South was militia, not continental lines like we imagine with the blue coats.
Because you mentioned that the American side of the Battle of Charlotte features the North Carolina militia, the Mecklenburg County Mounted Militia under the command of Captain Joseph Graham, and the Lincoln County Mounted Militia. None of these groups were part of the so-called Continental Army, and correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
And why not?
Well, the Continental Army, first of all, the Continental Army, the bulk of it in the South had already been captured in May in Charleston. So the Continental Army under Benjamin Lincoln is surrounded by Cornwallis and Clinton. When they come in, they besiege the city, and they capture 90% of the Continental Army in the South. So the Continental Army is dispersed and crushed, really. And bits of it that are fleeing back are caught by Tarleton at the Battle of the Waxhaws and massacred. Mm-hmm. So all that's left in the South, there's some Continental folks in Virginia and North Carolina, but they're not coordinated down here. And remember, the Continental Army have just gotten routed at the Battle of Camden again, right, in August. So the Continental Army is broken in the South. We're just dealing with militia companies.
This is local self-defense.
You're right. That's exactly right.
So I mentioned that this was a significant battle. It wasn't really a significant battle in terms of the war, but it was a kind of turning point because, as I understand it, never again in the war would the British mount a successful or a very successful offensive. Right. Is that because of something that happened here to break their spirit, or was it just because the Americans in other parts of the country heard about this and took heart from it? Or was it just simply a coincidence that this was the beginning of the end for the British in America?
It's probably – I'll let Chaz answer too. I think it's probably the latter. What happens is the British are stalled here. They're trying to get to Hillsborough. They're stalled here. They're harassed. Their communications are cut off. And as they wait here for 2 weeks, the Battle of Kings Mountain happens. And so off to their left flank, Patrick Ferguson's army is completely destroyed. Mm. So they realize – our entire flank is open. We're kind of cut off here by ourselves. We need to get to the coast so we can reach our French or our British ships.
Now, Chaz Fagan is here, and he knows a lot about this. And I guess your interest in this is what propels you into making these sculptures for
Absolutely.
Us. Because we need some stuff like that. We don't have a lot of sculpture around, that at least not that people like. We have a lot of Gumbies and things like that. But anyway, what other historic sculptures are planned?
Well, there's one upcoming, and it's of Thomas Spratt and King Hagler of the Catawbas.
Okay.
And the origin of that, or the reason for that, was their particular friendship relationship and how that forged a bond between the white community and the Catawbas that went on through the Revolution.
He was the first king and only king, I think, of the Catawbas.
Well, and there's debate as to whether he was the chief, but he took on the name of king, and then eventually those changed back to chief, but. That was just his particular name. The point of interest that ties into this is Thomas Spratt.
Uh-huh.
When I mentioned the Wahab plantation, he was injured there. So just a few days before this, the Battle of Charlotte, he's injured very badly, and he's got two bullets in his thigh. And he makes his way back to his house, which is in Fort Mill on the Catawba lands where he lived. And Cornwallis came to his plantation and took everything. All the food, all the fence posts for wood, et cetera, et cetera. But on the complete flip side of what we think of with Cornwallis and what he did with Captain James Jack, Cornwallis sent his surgeon to work on Spratt's thigh.
And this statue will be at the CPCC Culinary Art School. They're the beneficiary of all the great work that's going on here.
Well, it's along the Greenway.
Okay. You have a habit of creating, I only have 15, 20 seconds here, of creating public sculpture that becomes part of the fabric of a place, sculpture that lasts for centuries, and people forget who the artist was, but they don't forget the sculpture. What's it like to create a piece that will last long after you're gone, but you'll be anonymous?
Well, that's okay. As long as the story's good, that's what we want to get out.
Really?
So you want to maintain that story. These people, the people that are featured are the ones that can't be forgotten.
Chaz Fagan, sculptor, artist, and the man who's responsible for the Captain Jack statue down there at the fountain on the Greenway in front of CPCC. Scott Seifert, the co-founder of the May 20th Society. Remember the Battle of Charlotte, Friday, this week, 1780. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production.